Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It's a seriously good bit of kit, I promise you. I'm pleased to endorse it. And thank you to them for supporting this podcast. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk, Cooker spelt Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. Now, on today's podcast, we welcome back a friend of the podcast, Paul McGee, who is a I describe him as a self-help guru, motivational speaker. He's written a load of books on how to deal with life. The most famous being Sumo, Shut Up, Move On, Sumo, which was a fantastic book. It put him on the map and he sold loads and it's still a great book. He's the master of simplification and making his books easy to read. It's so easy to understand all his principles. He's recently released a book for teenagers teaching them how to cope with life. It's called Yes, The Sumo Secrets of Being a Positive, Confident Teenager. And well, I seriously recommend this book for young people, and I recommend Sumo for older people. Simple Coping Mechanisms for Life. If you want to know the sort of stuff that he talks about, you can listen to the first podcast we did together, which was episode number 64. Well worth a listen to that. Anyway, today's podcast question is, what are some coping methods for mentally dealing with this pandemic? I think we all need some of those. Let's have a chat. Here's Paul McGee. Paul, welcome to the podcast. Lovely to have you back on. How are you? You had COVID.
I did indeed, Tim. It's good to be back. I had COVID actually in the early days, if you want to call it the early days, back in the middle of March. So one of the first people, it seems, in Warrington to get the virus. Hit me quite hard on one level. Night sweats, high temperature, extreme fatigue. But it never went to my lungs. It never affected my breathing. Took me a good 2 weeks to get over it. But I know some people get concerned about what are the long-term impacts. But as far as I know, I'm thriving health-wise. I feel great. And just fortunate, really, that I was able to get through it and hopefully come through it well.
Yeah, it's what the strangest thing about this disease, it affects everybody in different ways, doesn't it? And I think that's one of the biggest problems.
I think it is. And everyone, even just if you think about the whole lockdown impact, where you were psychologically before this event probably has therefore influenced how you're handling it, and where you were maybe physically as well potentially could do. So, and I think the key thing is, anyone who's can talk with certainty about this virus, I would really question and would probably say is not that believable. Particularly your so-called experts with no medical background. At the end of the day, Tim, I got a CSE grade 3 in biology in 1980. So when people say, what do you think about the virus and will we get a second wave and how do you think the government's handling it? I'm like, well, you know, I can give you an opinion, but it's just an opinion. And I think some people are very skilled at presenting an opinion as if it's a fact. And sometimes those opinions, I think, actually can scare people because we're always spouting off worst case scenarios. Because I'd had many years ago ME or chronic fatigue syndrome. So all of a sudden I'm seeing all these articles that if you've had ME and then you get COVID-19, then you're almost doomed. Well, I made a choice. I might have seen the headline, but I wasn't going to read the article. And so far, a few months after I've been ill, I'm not doomed and I'm doing okay.
I'll tell you what I think is a fact is mentally I was coping really well with life before I went into the lockdown. And then at the beginning of it, I coped really well because I was looking after my children. And then when the lockdown sort of eased slightly, my children decided they were going to go, my twins went back up to North London to hang out with some of their friends, and my little daughter was going backwards and forwards, and I was sort of left on my own. It then really hit me hard, the where we were at. And when I sort of did like a survey with my friends, everyone who's single is really struggling. And people who are in a family, they might be struggling, but it seems easier. And my conclusion, which is my fact, even though, again, I only got a B in biology, but my fact is, so I know nothing about medicine or anything, but my fact is that we need human company. And I think this is the biggest problem with a pandemic is making us live individual lives is just not healthy, I don't think. And I think that is where people come unstuck.
I think I 100% agree. Because I've obviously been doing a lot of webinars and virtual events literally around the world over the last sort of few months. So I've dived deep into, I suppose, how we cope with change, challenge and uncertainty. And one of my conclusions very much backs up what you've said. Humans need humans. We need connection. Now, again, a bit like how the virus affects people differently, I think some people need levels of connection more than others. So you might have that introvert who's very happy with their own company, but they still need the company of other people. And I think a couple of things that come to mind. One, if you think about how you cope with things early on in the lockdown, I come across a lot of people and a lot of businesses who say, our staff coped really well at the beginning. And I think there was this sense in which we're all in this together, you know, 3 or 4 months down the line, we'll be through it, we'll have flattened the curve. And it gave them almost a sense of meaning and purpose. And we're going to clap the NHS. And then all of a sudden, this sprint became a marathon. And also, if you think about your situation, Tim, you know, having your daughters with you gives you that sense of meaning, that purpose, maybe a bit of a structure. You take those away and people struggle. And what I found, I mean, at one stage, I was living with my son, who is a doctor, which was quite handy, and his wife, and then my daughter and her boyfriend. So there were 6 of us in the house, which maybe gave me almost like too much connection at times. I was after the space of a solace and silence. But what I've noticed is when you are alone with your thoughts and those worries are whirling around your mind, you haven't always got, if you're on your own, the people to kick those ideas around with, and you can go deep into yourself. I think you can even in some cases go into some dark places where you've got other people around you. Then there's other issues like who's going to empty the dishwasher and a few other things. And it's my turn to sort of decide what series we're watching on Netflix. There's those mundane, trivial things that are actually massively important to our daily existence. And connection is so, so crucial. And I think that's the big thing that's come out. And most people say, oh, yeah, we're not going to return to our offices. Trust me, Tim, I'm working with all kinds of companies in the US, in Australia, in the UK and further afield. And I don't think it's completely believed that, oh, yeah, from now on, everyone is coping with virtual. We never need to go back to our offices. Some people are desperately, desperately missing that connection they get from work, that structure, that purpose, the banter, the conversations over coffee. It's been a huge, huge issue. And it's one that isn't going to go away immediately.
I saw my friend the other day and she's a lawyer, and I remember thinking to myself, because everyone was really gung-ho at the beginning about how they loved working from home and everything, and I thought, my God, you've done all that work, you've gone through all the law school, and you've done everything to sit on a laptop in Costa Coffee, really? And it's like, I'm sorry, that's not glamorous, you're right. People, they all sat at home for ages going, this is great, and then people started going, okay, it's all right, but maybe I'll go to a coffee bar because I'm bored and I want to see some humans. What people really want to do is go back to their plush offices and stuff eventually. I just think hopefully the way it will work is employers will realize that they can give more flexibility. So I think that's another positive which has come out of this.
It'll be like a hybrid experience, yeah, won't yeah. it? And I think, I mean, interestingly enough, 2 weeks ago, I did actually do a live in-person event in Middlesbrough. So it's a good 2.5 hour drive for me. I stayed at my Premier Inn the night before. I went on my own into the Toby Carvery and all those little mundane things, but they were really good to do. And the only bizarre thing was when I did this event and they had about 40 people in the room, all socially distanced, they had it live streamed to another part of the hospital as well. But I had to wear a mask and deliver my session wearing a mask, and everyone else was in a mask. And at times, towards the end of the session, when we'd finished, people coming up and going, I got so much from it. And it was like coming up to you, and this woman says, I'm such a hugger, and I'm finding this really difficult to do. And you just, it's this surreal experience. You're having this conversation whilst you're wearing a mask. And so, yeah, we've got some time to get through this, but I think we will hopefully, and it might not always be the case, hopefully we will value and appreciate people and connection more than we've perhaps ever done before.
Yeah, and my biggest problem, which I've discussed a few times on this podcast, is more to do with, because you talked about people going very dark. I went very dark and I discussed it on Sunday brunch one day. It just came out and I discussed it and I got such massive feedback from people going, oh God, thank God you said that because I'm really struggling. One of the things you say, it's, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint, which is a great way of looking at it. And sadly, our politics in this country, well, it's, I wouldn't say it's broken. It's not broken, but it's broken for a pandemic. We don't have strong leadership. We don't know what we're doing. And I understand that because it's a new thing. But then what we have is we have everyone playing political games and we're all aware of them. Normally we just ignore them all, don't we? Oh, there's Boris and Keir Starmer or Jeremy Corbyn or Nicola Sturgeon or whoever. They're all playing their stupid little games. We're all aware of them and we're watching it, the power struggling the game. But now we're going, hold on a second, we're really struggling here, guys. You know, now we can't keep playing these games. I've just been watching PMQs and I just thought, this is pathetic. We're in the middle of a pandemic and you two, Keir and Boris, are at each other. It's a time where we need to come together. And, you know, there's so many people doing... I obviously wasn't in the Second World War, but there was obviously a time Churchill took a lead at some stage and went, right, we're going to do this and this is how we're going to do it. Everyone keeps on equating this to the Second World War, which I'm not sure is a great thing. But we look around and I think we're going to be in this forever because we have no leadership. And then I look across to Sweden and they have a plan. Whether it's right or wrong, I don't know. Mm-hmm. They seem to have a plan. And all we're doing is just hacking away at each other again in a House of Commons. And it's I don't know, I find it so fruitless and poor for us as the people to watch.
It is, but it's also, I mean, one of my tips that I talk about in kind of how do you manage your own mental and emotional well-being is to manage your mental diet. And for me, part of managing my mental diet, I've got this term CNN, which I know is a network, news network in based in Atlanta in the States. But CNN for me is also going to stand for constant negative news. And the thing that I've realized and been more mindful of is when you think about the politics and you can think about how each other's going on, you know, with political point scoring, is also to ask ourselves, okay, but what consuming all of this content, what is it actually doing for my well-being, my emotional state, my mental state? Because I enjoy engaging with people on Twitter. I stick to my own lane, if you like, in terms of motivation and football, bit of humour, and promoting some of the ideas that I've got. But although I have some awareness of politics, what I realised, Tim, was when I start reading all the comments that happen, I literally can go into a dark place now, and I'm thinking to myself, it's almost a question I've now got at the back of my mind when I'm reading anything, whatever it's on social media, on some website, or from watching the news, which is rare. Is what I'm hearing, is it making me angry or anxious in any way? Because if it's doing both of those, it's time to stop consuming that. Because politicians will behave the way they will. Whatever I think about the decision to put Manchester, which is just up the road from me, and Liverpool, which is just up the road from me, into tier three, no matter what I can think about government's reasons for it, I don't actually influence or control any of that. The only thing I can control is what I'm focusing on. And I've got this little phrase, you know, what you focus on magnifies. And I think for some of us, it's so easy just to focus on stuff that you go, this is not doing us good. It's like we're getting information, but it's like junk food for the soul, for the mind, and it's just not healthy. It's not nourishing us. So I think we need to just be really mindful about what we're consuming and, as I say, manage your mental diet.
I agree with you no end on this. And we're also having empathy overload, I think, because we're being told about all the atrocities which are going on in the world constantly, and there's nothing we can do about them. We're sitting in Britain, and yet we have to engage with it, apparently, otherwise we're bad people. And this is look at an extreme case, Chris Pratt, for instance, the Hollywood movie star. I don't know when this is going to go out, Paul, but at the time of writing this, Chris Pratt has been, I haven't read all of the articles. I'm doing what you're doing, trying to limit the amount of news I did. But apparently Chris Pratt's not been political enough. And so people are saying he's a useless Hollywood movie star because he's not coming out saying he hates Trump. There's that whole expression that silence is violence, which is happening at the moment. If you're not joining in, you're part of the problem. And it's like, whoa, hold on a second. So on one hand, we're saying, look, don't consume too much news. But on the other side, it's like, what's your opinion on Hong Kong? Oh, God, I'm not sure. Well, then you're part of the problem because we need the world to unite. And it's like, we need the world to unite. It's like, but I can't do everything. And there you've got, and I think during pandemic, Paul, it all, because we're all just sitting at home, we're all online, every issue became bigger and more important.
Everything got amplified. But I mean, one little phrase is when people say, you know, what's your opinion on Hong Kong? What about this? What about that? It's like, you know what? I kind of resigned from being general manager of the universe a few years ago, and I'm just focusing on what I can do. I've got a little interesting story from a few years ago. 1989, two significant things happened, one for me and one for another guy. I'm sure lots of other significant things happened in 1989. I lost my job through ill health and I became ill with ME, or chronic fatigue syndrome. And also a book came out in the United States that went worldwide and became a global bestseller called 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by a guy called Dr. Stephen Covey. Remarkably, 18 years later, I was speaking at the same conference as him in Australia. And by this stage, he's, world leaders want time with Dr. Stephen Covey. And amazingly, he was on stage 8:30 till 9:30 in the morning. And then I was following him. I was determined I would get a few minutes with Dr. Stephen Covey. And the only way I was able to do it was I got into the auditorium really nice and early, and security let me in because I said, look, I'm one of the speakers this morning. I need to do a sound check and check my slides. And lo and behold, Covey is doing exactly the same. So he's done his slides and everything. I have a quick chat with him. First thing this great leadership guru wants to talk about is his grandchildren. Believe it or not, he's got 52 grandchildren. Sadly, he's died now, and I wonder whether on the death certificate, you know, cause of death, exhaustion. But one of the things I asked him was, out of all your 7 habits, which one is the most important to you? And he went, well, they're all important, but you've got to think about number one. And number one is be proactive. And in his book, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, imagine you've got two circles. You've got a small circle, and imagine that's coloured in green, and then an outer circle that surrounds it is coloured in white. And Covey's point is the white circle, if you like, is our circle of concern, but which we've got no control over. And if you think about it, there are a lot of things we've got no control over. When the vaccine, when we're going to get the vaccine, when we're going to be able to be not socially distanced, when we're coming out of tier 3, tier 2, or whatever. But Covey's point was, when you focus a lot on that outer circle, the stuff that concerns you, but you can't control or influence, a couple of things can happen. One, your stress and anxiety can increase because you're feeling more and more powerless because there's nothing you can do. But also, your confidence and motivation can decrease. And Covey's point was, he doesn't use the color green. It's my little way of making it more visual. But his point was, you've got to focus on that inner circle. In other words, you've got to focus on the green zone, because the green zone is your sphere of influence and control. So I can't control when organizations are going to have me back in person, delivering at conferences, etc. But what I can control in my inner circle, my green zone, is, okay, maybe I can do virtual sessions. Maybe I can make my sessions more engaging and fun, not rely on slides, but rely on flip charts, props, music, have a little bit of fun, but pack in loads of ideas. And I think, Tim, the thing we've got to keep on thinking about is, every single day, as you know, you and I know Drew Povey, but he's got this little phrase, every day is a Tuesday, C-H-O-O-S-E. And every day is a Tuesday. And I've got a choice every single day, because I have. And that is, do I focus on that white circle and have what I'll call a bit of a BMW session, a bitch, moan and a whinge about stuff I can't do anything about? And maybe I do, maybe I need a little bit of a BMW session, but make it brief and then think, okay, green zone. What's in my green zone? What can I influence? What can I improve? What can I control? And I've been sharing with my sort of audiences I've been working with virtually. There's things you can't control in your outer world, But there are definitely things that you can control in your inner world. And it is a marathon, and it is step by step, day by day. And every day is a Tuesday. Focus on that green zone, what you can do. Because when people are being all self-righteous, which no offense, I think some people are, about what's your opinion on Hong Kong and what's your opinion about what Boris is doing. Hey, you know, I get it. There's a release of serotonin in your brain because you feel a bit more self-righteous for talking about these things and tweeting about them. Well, no flipping, you know, no offense. You tweeting about something doesn't change anything. But when you're giving to the homeless, when you're supporting a food bank, when you're sponsoring a child abroad for £20 a month, you're in your green zone, you're making a difference.
Yeah. Right. Okay. I'm going to pick up on those points, which gets us really nicely into your book. Just first of all, Drew Povey, by the way, is the headmaster from Educating Manchester. Great guy. We both know him. He's been on this podcast. If you want to search it out, he's now a motivational. What do you call him? A motivational speaker?
He's a leadership guru. He's amazing at what he does.
He's a great guy. So dig that out. I interviewed a woman called Dottie who wrote a book called... Outraged, I think it was called, about the outrage of the internet. And when you say it doesn't have any, by tweeting, doesn't have an effect. Okay, this is fascinating because it gets us right onto your book. It does, sadly. What it does is it's like wearing your leather jacket or you're having your Mohican. It's a signal to all your friends. This is what I'm into. This is the issue I'm into. So you get into it. But the youth of today or the younger people are politically engaged, like we were, Paul, when we were young, because things were crap when we were young. There was lots of racism, there was lots of strikes, there was a lot of, you know, things were right and left wing. There was a lot of stuff going on when we were younger, and so people were politically engaged. Then all through the sort of late 80s, 90s, noughties, it all got quite nice for us. So I think we'll look back and really appreciate those days. And now we've gone back to where we've moved to the two. We're getting left and right wing views again, I think, and it's not so much in the middle at the moment. But I think the kids are politically engaged, and it's part of their culture to do it. Sadly, with the internet and technology, it's being bombarded, and we're all being sucked into it because they own the technology. They're the young people. They're the ones doing it, and I feel that we're all being dragged into this, where we're the wise ones who go, whoa, step away. I'm a TV presenter. Never get involved in politics because I know it's a dangerous territory to go. But even I feel myself being dragged into it sometimes, going, no, why are you saying that? What side am I on? Let's take a side. And I just try and stay out of it. But it has become a thing for everyone. And I'm not sure it's good for our mental health.
No, I think the thing I just think we just need to appreciate is me expressing something in words doesn't mean I've actually consciously done something positive to make a difference. And we talk about the virtue signaling. And ultimately, judge a person by their fruit of their actions rather than simply their words. And for me, it's good to get debate. It's good to get some engagement. But sometimes I think, well, how worthwhile was that debate, particularly if you're discussing something with someone who is completely opposed to what you believe? So for me, Tim, I kind of keep it fairly simple. And again, go back to green zone. What can I be doing to make a little bit of a small difference in the world today, whatever that looks like? And yes, people are more engaged, but I think we just need to realise that it's words can change worlds. But we need to follow up with some kind of actions as well. So I just think we need to be mindful of what we're consuming and actually thinking we've achieved something because we've had an opinion and because we've called somebody out. I think we can do life in a more effective way. And I don't want to be, you know, at the end of your days, don't want to be the kind of person who went, yeah, I trolled a lot of people. I called a lot of people out. Great, good for you. You had this privilege of being on this planet, and is that all you did? Don't just be critical, make a contribution in some way. And don't just criticize, come up with an alternative, come up with something constructive, come up with some solutions. Anyone can be a cynic on the sidelines. Get involved with the struggle, whatever that looks like for you.
Every time I go on the internet, I can't help it, but your beach ball analogy just hits me so hard all the time, Because for anyone who doesn't know, Paul's beach ball analogies, and you're in a room and you've got all the colours on the beach ball, but it's the huge beach ball and you can only see one part of it, and another person on the other side can only see the other part of it. So you think the beach ball is red, white and blue, and the other one thinks yellow, green and orange or something. And you've got to understand that you should see the beach ball from their point of view. And I love that analogy always. Because I look on the online, I think when you look at both sides of the argument, both sides are probably right in their own way, or they think they're right. The hatred going towards the other side is phenomenal. And it's like, they are wrong. I want everyone to see it from my point of view. I think there's a lot of mentally ill people on the online at the moment.
But feeling self-righteous and that you are right does give you a bit of a serotonin rush. And so you feel quite morally justified. Believe it or not, when you call someone out in that kind of way, it almost like boosts your self-esteem. It's not a healthy way to do it, and putting somebody down by elevating yourself up. But I think there are reasons why people do this. And I just don't think that we've, I'm one of the reasons why I've got the book for young people, and obviously, you know, Don't Forget Your Beach Ball is one of my sumo secrets in the book. It's just to try and help children be a bit more flexible in their thinking. You know, there's a book written called The Sin of Certainty. And I think we can get very fixed in our mindset about a lot of different things. And I think for me, it's about being flexible, about being fluid. It's about going, guess what? I might have been on this planet 56 years, but I've got a lot to learn. I want to remain curious. And again, a word we don't hear a lot about. I want to remain humble, which means constantly open to learning. And boy, is this a crucial one. Being open to the possibility of actually changing my mind on things.
Yeah,
and people are so fixated on their view, they feel morally righteous, and actually, I think we're destroying other people. But I think by our comments, but I think we're destroying ourselves really, and we're not in any way setting a great role model example to young people at all. It's really, really sad. And the whole thing with the internet, and I call social media and the internet is a bit like fire. Fire can, you know, it can warm your food, it can cook your food, it can keep you warm, it can also burn your house down. It's not the internet or the social media that's the problem, it's how it's actually used. And I have to say, Tim, there's a lot of great stuff that people use the social media for as well. And I don't want to get things completely out of hand.
John Ronson, who's
perspective to this.
John Ronson, who did a book called So You've Been Publicly Shamed, he has been on this podcast as well, and he's talking about this book. And he will point out that when people do get publicly shamed, the person who starts the shaming generally ends up in a pretty shitty place as well. If you start that ball rolling, you end up as one of the casualties of it as well. So be careful who you're trying to publicly shame. Let's talk about the book then. Yes, The Sumo Secrets to Being a Positive, Confident Teenager. I think it could not be more timely to have this book out. Again, Paul, you've done it. Again, fantastic book. I picked it up and I managed to read it in an afternoon, because the art, as I said in my intro, the art of your books is the simplicity. And that's not me downgrading it. You make it so easy to get the points across, and you make it such a lovely read with the way you do it, with your analogies, which we can all hear on the podcast. It's such a beautiful book. And bizarrely, I don't know what age it's for, but I'm as soon as I finish this podcast, I'm putting this, my daughter's at university at the moment, and they're struggling a bit with their experience of the first time of being at university, and I'm going to send it up to them, because I think they could do with this just common sense, simplistic ideas for leading a happy life. What made you want to do it?
I myself, and thanks for your comments on that, Tim, and I think it's fair to say, I think anyone from the age of 9 onwards is probably going to get something from the book. I'm getting people tell me on Twitter, I brought this from my grandchildren, but I've ended up reading it myself before I give it to them.
Paul, I know your ideas, but I read it again because I love it. And it's just, it's brilliant reminder of them all, because they are just common. Yeah. Oh, they're fantastic.
And the illustrations as well, which an illustrator did a magnificent job on. Why did I want to write the book? I ran away from home at the age of 10. And had a very psychologically, emotionally abusive stepfather. And you don't run away from home at the age of 10 unless you got some serious stuff kicking on. It was a cry for help. I was only missing a few hours. And I suppose as I went through my teenage years and into my 20s, and then I started getting into personal development. I always remember when I lost my job for ill health, someone gave me, and this ages me now, a cassette tape. And on this cassette tape was this little phrase, within every adversity is a seed of equal or greater opportunity. And I kind of clung on to that. You know, I've lost my job. I don't know if I'll ever get well. My own doctor doesn't think it's a genuine illness, sends me to see a psychiatrist in Liverpool. It was a humiliating and difficult time. Not going to Liverpool, by the way, but the psychiatrist, just to clarify. And boom, boom. And I suppose as I got older, it was like me, I've used to think, I wish I'd known this when I was a kid. I wish I'd known not just about the Battle of Hastings happening in 1066, but if I had some language and ideas and tools on how to deal with my own internal inner conflicts and my conflicts with my stepfather, my conflicts with other people in my life, my peers. And I got to the point in where, I mean, I say I write adult books, and I don't mean of the, you know, the 50 Shades of Grey variety, but I write books for adults. And people used to say to me, you should write a book for kids. And there was a part of me in my head was kind of like going, even though I wrote a book called Self-Confidence, there was a part of me that went, yeah, but I don't write for kids, do I write for adults? And so I kept putting it off and putting it off. And then I'd be at a conference and someone put up this quote, and it really hit me between the eyes. It was from a guy who lived in the 1800s called Frederick Douglass, who was a former escaped slave and ended up in politics. And I'll paraphrase what he said, but he said something like, it's easier to build strong children than to repair broken adults. And I remember thinking, yeah, if we can give kids the tools for life when they're young, it's not just about stats, it's not just about exams and results, it's about tools for life. You know, build strong children. Maybe we won't have some of the issues we do have with broken adults. I mean, apparently, according to Young Minds, the mental health charity, or more so raising some money for through the sales of the book, I think they quoted some research that said, and I think the World Health Organization said something similar, that 50% of the mental health problems we experience, for 50% of us, they've started to occur before we're 14. And so I've got my own childhood experiences. I've got some tools that I learned more in my late 20s, early 30s and 40s that have helped me and thought, how can we get this for kids? And there's another quote I came across, which said, prepare the child for the road. And it's like, yeah, the road of life is going to have its speed bumps, it's going to have its challenges and its setbacks. You've got to prepare the child for the road. But the quote went on to say, unfortunately, now we want to prepare the road for the child. In other words, we want to smooth out all the speed bumps. We want to try and rid them of all the problems that are in life. And so it's a lot easier. Well, I'm not saying let's send kids back to cleaning chimneys and going back to the Victorian age, but hang on a minute. We need to prepare the child for the road, because you, no matter how much you try and prepare the road, there will be challenges. There'll be pit holes. There'll be potholes even. There'll be those speed bumps. And the thing is, the more we cosset children, there's a book written by Jonathan Haidt called The Coddling of the American Mind. The more we overprotect children and don't let them fail and don't let them take risks and know what it's like to make a mistake and to come back, then when I speak to teachers, one of the number one things they say is children lack resilience. And so what I wanted to do also in the book, you know, let's build strong children rather than repair broken adults, is give children a set of skills and go, you know what, life's going to be a bit of a game of snakes and ladders sometimes. And if you want to win the game, there's always a chance you're going to fall, you're going to land on a snake. And when you land on the snake, don't quit too quick. Don't go, oh, this is terrible, and quit the game. You've got to kind of keep rolling the dice. And you might land on another snake, but you keep rolling the dice, because ultimately you do end up on ladders. And so I just want to give children some of the stuff that many of us have never had, some tools for life in a fun, creative, imaginative, yet easy to understand way. And just kind of go, sorry, but there are snakes on this board. That's why it's called Snakes and Ladders. And no matter how much we try and make the game easy and simple for you, guess what? If there were no snakes on the board, life would be a bit boring. Yes, you'd win the game, but there'd be no sense of satisfaction. And trying to help both adults and children go, actually, part of your success comes from having a struggle. Because when you struggle, then you strengthen yourself, you become stronger. And so there's countless reasons why I've written the book, Tim, but you know, I don't want to make a penny out of this book in terms of sales. I want to, you know, I'm getting clients saying to me, I want you to speak at this event and what you're charging. And I'm saying, do you know what? If you tell me what your budget is and you buy a load of these books and distribute them to your staff's family, you know, family members, or donate some to a school, then I will not charge you a fee. Buy the flipping books. Because I know I got an educational psychologist involved in giving me advice. I got a board, I call them my advisory board of young people aged 11 to 18. I wrote my first draft after doing loads of research and I just said, look, pull this apart. Tell me what works. Tell me what doesn't. And based on their feedback, I will say in all humility, yes, it's a cracking book. I've spent hundreds of hours working on it and I think it can make a real difference. And that'll be part of my legacy. You know, my legacy will be the longevity of this book, that in 10 years' time, kids will still be reading it and it'll be helping parents and other carers as well. So that was a flipping long answer to a short question, but good hopefully answer, you get though, the Paul. Passion behind it, not just seemed like a good idea.
Yeah, and again, I reiterate, it's tough. A lot of people don't like reading, and I read a lot of books, as you know. I'm always digging through these books, especially if it's anything to do with psychology or philosophy or self-help or any of those things. And the great thing about your books is you make them so easy to read, and especially if you're a teenager, you can pick it up and you can whack it out in a couple of days if you like that book, and you learn so much. Well, a couple of things I pick up on there, which is really interesting, is we do learn at a very young age coping mechanisms, and we learn poor coping mechanisms off our parents. Like I probably gave my children, I didn't start learning good coping mechanisms until I was probably in my 40s. I learned bad ones, which was revenge policy and go for a run, revenge policy, go out, you know, don't worry, get back on the horse type thing, you know, and just keep going. And I only learned good ones latterly. I also think I learned taking responsibility for my life, which is what you talk about in mm-hmm. your books, and especially this. And I think that is important, because we do. I'll come back to that, because the other one I like is the break the circle as well, which is sort of something that if you read this book, you have the ability to not just keep living like your parents lived and their parents lived. You can actually break the cycle and not take on all those problems and actually go and achieve something and do something for yourself. Be responsible for your life on this planet. You've got one go at it, so become responsible. And you really reiterate this a lot in the book, which I love.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, no parent was waking up in the morning going, how can I screw it up for my kids today? Well, most parents anyway. But we hand me down our beliefs from how we were brought up and how we were raised, and then we pass it on to our children. And we don't do it intentionally to screw them up, but we kind of like think this is the best way to do it. And I in the book, I talk about the word belief, B-E-L-I-E-F. But if you look at the word, you know, in the middle of the word is the letters L-I-E. And I just want to make a point that, you know, some of our beliefs about ourselves are lies that we've learned as we're growing up, and we've been conditioned by, you know, by maybe parents who, this is what children should do and this is what they shouldn't do. And I just wanted to give a language and, as I say, these sets of tools really to help children. I mean, one of the book's called Yes, and you know, what's Yes about? It's about being curious. It's about not giving up too quick, about too soon. It's about saying yes to my potential. And you know, one of the things that I actually have in the book, it's saying yes to sometimes questioning and challenging adults sometime. We need to break that circle, that cycle you talk about.
Yeah, Paul, and one of the most important things is it's okay to feel sad, which you reiterate constantly in your books. It's not a bad bad place. You call it your hippo, but you've got it. It's okay to sit there and go, I feel really crap. I did bad in an exam. I didn't get picked for a team or something. It's okay.
Totally.
But don't spend don't let it influence the rest of your life.
You see, the challenge we've got now, I spoke at a conference with a professor called Tanya Byron, and she read, brilliant psychologist. And she has a column in the Times. And the thing that she was saying is that young people are mentally health savvy, and they're savvy with the language and one thing and another. And the problem we've got with some of that is if you're having a bad day or you've had a bad 2 days, you call yourself depressed. And now I've got a problem. And maybe I need medication. And maybe I need help and support. And maybe you do. But part of my perspective is, hello, this is life. And sometimes you might feel sad. And the fact that you're not in a permanent state of happiness doesn't mean there is something wrong with your world. Yeah, what do hippos do in mud? They wallow. And sometimes we need that little bit of a wallow. I mean, I've produced some posters as well based on some of the ideas in the book that I want to kind of like give away to schools. And one of them is, it's okay to not always feel okay. To feel mad, bad or sad sometimes is okay. And another one is, you know, seeking support isn't a sign of weakness. It's a sign that you're really smart. And I want young people to kind of get those messages and sometimes to go, yeah, no, I'm having a great day. I'm having a bit of a hippo day. But the other point I mentioned, Tim, which is really important for everyone, is hippo time is okay, but it's temporary. It's a detour. It's not a destination. And it's just helping young people to understand their feelings and their emotions a bit more, and sometimes stick with your sadness.
Right.
Digest your disappointment, those kind of things.
I must say, I was speaking to some woman the other day who works in HR, and we were having this conversation, and she said she thinks it's fashionable at the moment to be a victim. You talk about victim culture in there, and you do say it's temporary. I think it's becoming quite fashionable. You know, like when we were growing up, there were the goths. I don't know if they still exist, the ones who wanted to sit around and be miserable all day as a fashion item. But I think it's become quite mainstream for people to say everything's wrong, everything's bad in the world. I'm terrified, speaking to my daughters. I said to them the other day, do you think the world's in a bad place? They said, oh, Dad, it's absolutely terrible, isn't it? Now, this is before the pandemic. And I'm like, really? What's the facts backing that up? And I just think, I thought that before the pandemic hit, I think, you know, it depends what stats you go with, but the world's in quite a good place. But because of technology and media and everything else, the impression is it's in a terrible place. And the impression is it's awful to be a young person in society. Just want to say one more thing before we get in this. There is a fact, actually, that people always say, you know, and I have made this mistake with my daughters, and I said to them, oh, you're just going through a bit of a troubled time. Don't worry, it'll pass over, when there was a bit of arguing going on between the girls at school. And then I realized that their life is actually different to mine. And I think as parents, we've got to understand that, my life was different to my parents, their life was different to their parents. However, I do think the kids' lives at the moment are really hard mentally. It's an absolute fact, and I'm quoting it as a fact because I heard it the other day, technology is making teenage girls, especially, but teenagers, really sad because it never switches off.
I think there are times when it isn't just an opinion, it is a fact. And if I agree with you as well, and you agree with me, that's clearly a fact. That's the definition of a fact, isn't it, Tim? Well, Paul McGee and Tim Lovejoy think this is the case. So therefore, it is now a qualified fact. The reality is, you're right. I mean, when I talk about hippo time, you want to talk about, you know, being a victim or wearing the victim T-shirt. I think what I want to really stress is there are genuine victims, you know, and we need to be very clear on that, who need help and support.
Definitely.
I think we also, some people crave attention, and maybe they crave attention because they never got it from any of their family. And all of a sudden they put something out on social media, and because they maybe present themselves as a victim, they get loads of attention. So there's reasons that drive people's behavior. But I think you were very right about this whole thing about what, you know, I hate the term snowflakes. It's an insult to teenagers. You know, we need to understand their side of the beach ball. They're having to think about Brexit. They're bombarded, not just with what's on social media, but a news network that only gets your attention by either making you angry or fearful. It's not going to be logical and rational. It's not going to go, actually, I know we're in the middle of a global pandemic, but historically, this is probably the best time in the history of the world to ever be born and to be a teenager. They're not going to hear that. They're going to hear all these horror stories, and of which there's definitely truth in them, but they're also the exception often rather than the rule. Like, tragically, when you hear about people who have had COVID and have died, but you're not going to hear a story about Paul McGee was a 55-year-old middle-aged bloke and made a full recovery. That's not newsworthy. So they're getting bombarded with lots of different things. They're being told, which is potentially true, I don't want to make a political statement, you know, the older generation have screwed it for you because of Brexit. Now you've got the pandemic. Now you've got all this uncertainty. And your mates, if they want, can abuse you online and troll you. And also, when you're feeling low and having hippo time, one thing to say in the book, the last thing you want to do is to go on Instagram. But you do so. Teenagers do need the tools, and they need a little bit more compassion rather than simply this toughen up approach. Because you are right, we don't know what it is like to be in their world and to be exposed to all that they're being exposed to. And you know what we're robbing people, young people of at the moment? Hope for the future. There is still a hope. But the way we talk about things, the way we frame things, no wonder some teenagers are on a real low that's lasted more than 24 hours or 48 hours. They're in deep hippo time. And I think adults need to be saying, look, this is flipping tough. There's not a script for how you deal with a pandemic. But you know what? We are going to get through it. And you, as the young people, you will do some teaching to us of how we need to deal with this. And I'm writing a book at the moment on happiness, believe it or not. You know, as you do in the middle of a global pandemic, yet another book. One of the laws of happiness, it's called the 10 laws of happiness. Law number one, thou shalt not pursue happiness. We won't talk about that. But law number two is thou shalt make manure when shit happens. And there is a lot, pardon my language, a lot of shit happening at the moment. And we can either wallow in it and smell of it and stink of it, or we can go, what are we going to do to make manure here? What are we going to grow out of this crisis? The word crisis, if it was written in Cantonese, is made up of two Chinese characters. The first one is threat. The second one is opportunity. And I think we need to make sure that we're equipping our young people to go, we're going to get opportunity through this. It's not just a threat. You still have a future because you'll be involved in creating your future. So I want to, within the midst of the pandemic and all the pain and the problems, give a bit of hope for the future. Because I do think, Tim, when we work together and don't just slag each other off on social media, we can still make some manure out of all that we're going through at the moment.
Yeah, I'm going to be a bit controversial here, and my listeners might not like this, but every time I watch young people be slagged off for going out and partying, I think they've got very short memories, especially a lot of my friends, of what we were like. I think it's a bit of a tough ask to ask. The people I feel sorry for are the teenagers and early 20s and something, and the really old people, because their lives, they haven't got many years left and they don't really want to spend it on their own sitting in houses. And every year for them, because of maths, is a lot quicker, and it becomes poignant at the end of your life. At the beginning of your life, when you're young kids, you know, they want to go out, they want to drink, they want to party, they want to dance, they want to get laid, they want to do all the things that you should be able to do. And we're all like, oh, look at that lot, they're not joining in. It's like, oh Christ, remember what it was like for you when you had this bursting desire to mate, you know, you had a bursting desire to go out and have fun. And we're trying to tell them to not do it. There's this horrific case recently in Manchester of a student who was so overcome with anxiety about being locked away that he committed suicide. This has got to be a wake-up call. We're locking our children away, and then we're going, well, stick with the laws. It's like, I wasn't bloody doing that when I was a kid. I was never in. So, you know, from the age of 15, I was out every day.
There's a phrase, Tim, which you may have heard before, and I apologise if it's a bit of a cliche to people now, but I think it's worth repeating. We're all in the same storm, but we're in different boats. And what that young person's boat looks like is very, very different to someone who's maybe financially secure, in their 50s, you know, got nice open space, working from home, but they've got their own office. It's a different world to it is for some other people. And when I was asked, when I became ill with the virus, and then I started doing some interviews as a way of doing virtual events. Initially, we're doing interviews about things. And one of the questions was asked was, what's one of the things you've been learning through this whole crisis? And one of the words would be compassion. And it is just having a bit more compassion for where people are, rather than being quick to criticize, being quick to understand. You're very much, by what you've just said there, Tim, you're going, I'm trying to experience what it's like to be in their side of the beach ball at the moment, rather than condemn them for where they're at. And I think compassion and understanding are massively, massively important. And I think everyone would make sure that they go, hang on a minute, the boat I'm in might be a bit different to the boat you're traveling in. And I should understand that a little bit more, because it's the same storm, but with our modes of travel are very, very different at times.
Let's talk about, because the idea of this podcast, the question I want to ask is some coping methods for mentally dealing with the pandemic. Obviously, your book's great for teenagers. Oh, it's good for any age. But what are some of the tips you could give us that you think we could use for people sitting here and going, I feel pretty miserable and I'm in the middle of this?
Sure. Remind you of the Stephen Covey story. Focus on your green circle. Keep on asking yourself what you can control, and actually come to the point of going, I accept there are things out of my control I can't do anything about. I think you probably talked about sleep before, but I think it's one of our, it's our secret superpower that some people don't take seriously enough. And I think about sometimes just, if you can focus a bit more on your sleep, it can have, it's almost like the domino. The sleep is that first domino, because once you knock that down, it has a knock-on effect on so many other things. So if you start to get the sleep right, average of 7 to 9 hours a night, that can help. And if you, by the way, go, well, I'm often have all my worries when I go to sleep at night. Well, here's a phrase I came across. Sounds a bit weird. What you take to bed with you travels the night with you. What you take to bed with you travels the night with you. And I don't mean your teddy bear. In other words, what's the last thing you watch, listen to, read, or think about before you go to sleep? Brilliant. I have this little routine, this little ritual. As I drift off to sleep, I think about, what am I thankful for? F-O-U-R. Talk about it in the book for young people. Talked about it in previous books for adults as well. And so I replay my day thinking about four things I'm actually thankful for. There's so much science around the power of gratitude. So sleep and what am I thankful for? Secondly, particularly if you're working from home, this whole concept of rest is massively important. There's this phrase, you know, to be at your best, you need to rest. And actually, rest is not work's opposite, it's work's partner. And an analogy I use sometimes is, because when you were working maybe in an office, and I know you maybe didn't always have that for yourself, Tim, but a lot of your listeners will have. How would they know they'd finished the end of the day? Because they left their office to go home. When you're working from home, and we talk about this concept of working from home fatigue, is, well, you may be no longer working from home, you're sleeping at work. And that lounge and that kitchen is where you work, is also your home space. And I say to people, if you're reading a document, how do you know you've come to the end of a sentence? And it's like, they look at me a bit weird and go, because there's a full stop. Exactly. And part of my question to people is this, what's your full stop? At the end of the day, what's your little routine or ritual, your full stop that goes, that's me finished? Because for me, I'll end the day by going for a walk. But if you don't have a full stop and you think that work is something you've got to carry on doing, then you still got your laptop on your knee at 8 o'clock at night. Then you finally get around to watching some on Netflix at 9, 10 o'clock. Then you're going to bed late. And you're working almost like from a, I talk about the compound effect of fatigue. And one night's bad sleep isn't too much of a problem. But over time, not getting that sufficient rest, huge impact on you. So don't underestimate the importance of sleep. And if it's an issue, Google sleep hygiene and think about what you take to bed with you, travels the night with you. So what's the last thing you think about? And secondly, this whole thing about rest, it's not the opposite of work, it's work's partner. I mean, there are a couple of things. I've got loads more that I share with people, but that's your starter for two anyway.
You did a collaboration, didn't you, with your publisher to make your book How Not to Worry, available during this pandemic, free on Kindle for 5 weeks, 1,400,000 downloads. That really shows how people were suffering, doesn't it? I mean, it was a fantastic thing to do, by the way. Well done.
Yeah, well, to be fair, Tim, I mean, you know, I'm a motivational speaker, and at the start of this pandemic, I didn't know what I had to offer. And I was racking my brains, particularly when I got over the virus, thinking, what can I do? We were offering free webinars to clients, one thing and another. And then it was that I had a bit of an idea, then the publisher picked up on it. So it was big thanks to them, Capstone. And they just said, well, how would you feel if we made it downloadable for free on Kindle? It's normally, I don't know, £8 or £9. And I just went, look, if it's going to make a flipping difference, then great. And obviously get several thousand downloads. And you just hope, don't you? Like we all hope. Maybe there's one little thing that we do or we say on a daily basis that actually makes a bit of a difference to people. And some of us, you know, are doing that in the shadows without any profile, without any publicity. And whatever you do, I always say, guess what, folks? We're all mad. We all make a difference in whatever way it is. So let's just focus on maybe a small way we can make a difference to people. Hopefully the downloading of that book did help a number of people.
Do you still get down? Are you still learning?
Do you know, you said that. I remember the first time you interviewed me and you asked me that, and it's like 100%. If I'm honest, Tim, strangely enough, I feel so passionate about this book, yes, for young people, that I got down about it almost like prior to launch day, because we'd sent out over 200 press releases. We didn't seem to get anyone who was interested. And I'm like, oh no, this is my baby. This is so important. And then it was released on launch day, and I guess word of mouth, and I put it on social media, and it was my fastest selling book ever in the first like week. It's been out nearly 2 weeks now as we're recording this. It's still my fastest selling ever book. But of course I get down, and I got down about wondering how this book's going to do and will it get the profile that in all honesty, I believe it deserves. And I can be racked at times with a little bit of doubt. And I think, you know, yes, I wrote this book on confidence, but for me, I had to tell my publisher when they put some on the back cover of my confidence book, they went, you know, learn how to eliminate self-doubt. And I went, no, you can't use the word eliminate. Use the word manage. Because I don't think you always do eliminate doubt. It's learning to live with it. It's learning to make sure it's at the back of the bus, not at the front driving it. But I still have my doubts, and I still have my down days, and I still need my hippo time. But my own material at times helps me, and my wife as well, because we go for a walk every morning, and I feel like she's my therapist at times. She's not just my wife. And actually, when I say she's my therapist, what does she do above all, which we all have the ability to do? She gives me a good listening to. And I think that's a reminder for everyone else who doesn't always feel equipped to know how to support others. Very often, people aren't after a solution from you. They're just after solidarity. They're just after someone to hear them, to notice them, to stand with them. And that itself can have a powerful and profound impact on other people.
Do you know what? I think we've come full circle here, bizarrely, from right at the beginning where we said we want human interaction, human company, and that's half the thing. And I think one of the problems which I keep banging on about, I'm sure I'm boring my listeners, is when we look at our leaders at the moment, we think we don't believe them. We don't think they're talking and going, this is for your good. We think, no, you're doing it for your power. And we don't, you know, it's, I don't know. And I think there's one of the problems. The other problem is we want to spend time with people going, I feel a bit shitty about the pandemic. How do you feel? And they go, yeah, I feel shitty as well. Okay, we feel shitty together. And when you're left on your own, when you're left on your own, to your own devices, you just end up online looking up conspiracy theories, or in my case, looking up time travelers, aliens and stuff like that.
You're still able to laugh, but I would even say, I think even just having this conversation with you, Tim, you know, it's helpful. And it's helpful for me even talking about these things, hearing you laugh, you've made me laugh. And you think, okay, maybe you can't always spend time with people physically in their presence, but please still use technology, because it might not be, you know, it's not quite the same as being in the room with someone. No, but it's better than being on your own, just with your own thoughts.
Paul, I love talking to you as always. Thank you so much for doing this today. Your book, yes, The Sumo Secrets to Being Positive, Confident Teenager. I think that this is going to make an absolutely amazing Christmas present for someone. If you don't want to buy it for them now, wait till Christmas. But I mean, truly, I can't endorse this book enough. It's fantastic. And as I say, the biggest endorsement is I'm sending a copy each to my daughters because I think they need it. And I do think my daughters have insatiable appetite for reading. Yet every time I give them a book, they won't read it because I've given it to them. However, this one I think is so easy that I don't think they'll be able to put it down. So,
brilliant. No.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Oh, and if people want to connect with me, by the way, or give me any feedback on the book or anything else, I'm on Instagram at The Sumo Guy and I'm on Twitter at The Sumo Guy as well. So, love hearing from people. I do love social media and there's loads of good stuff about it. And I do love connecting and finding out how the book's made a difference to people.
Brilliant. Top man. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
Dear Lovejoy is written and hosted by Tim Lovejoy and produced by Blake Fallows. It's brought to you by Cooker, spelled Quooker. Check them out at cooker.co.uk. That's spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. If you want to get in touch with Tim, email dearlovejoy@gmail.com. And Tim is on Twitter @TimLovejoy. And on Instagram @TimLovejoy_official.